This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, the 27th of May, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast, the U.S. House passes a massive defense bill but fails to accelerate troop withdrawals from Afghanistan.
Despite the padding, U.S. military spending has to come down. There's a wide recognition of this that includes the administration.
In France, the G8 summit of world leaders calls for Libya's Colonel Gaddafi to step down and pledges $20 billion to Egypt and Tunisia. And in New York, opposition grows to a federal immigration program.
The unjustness, the unfairness of it, the dividing of families, and the lack of confidence and the lack of trust in our police communities.
Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A Northern Virginia district court ruled in support of legalizing corporate donations today. The ruling is expected to have ramifications throughout the political financing world. FSRN's Brad Kuttner has the story from Richmond.
Corporations and human beings are equally allowed freedom of speech, according to a district judge ruling from a federal bench in Alexandria. This freedom of speech allows corporations to voice their concerns financially just as citizens are. The final decision used precedent from last year's Citizens United case, which allowed corporations to campaign for officials with privately funded advertisements, but still denied direct donations. Today's ruling revoked that ban, giving corporations the right to donate directly to candidates independent of their employees. The ruling stems from a criminal case that accused two men of using corporate funds to reimburse their employees' political contributions to Hillary Clinton's campaign in 2006 and 2008. The courts did recognize limits on campaign contributions by corporations to $5,000 total per candidate. The case is expected to be appealed to the Supreme Court for a final decision. Brad Kuttner, FSRN, Richmond.
Just before midnight last night, President Obama signed a 4-year extension of the Patriot Act, the 9/11-era domestic spying authorization. The provisions were set to expire at the end of the day. A few hours before, the U.S. House voted to extend the legislation by a 250-153 vote. The Senate passed the bill 72-23. Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden, who is on the Senate Intelligence Committee and has access to classified information, argued that the government is abusing the powers laid out in the Patriot Act.
I believe there are two Patriot Acts in America. The first is the text of the law itself, and the second is the government's secret interpretation of what they believe the law means. And as an example, several years ago, Americans woke up to learn that the Bush administration had been secretly claiming for years that warrantless wiretapping was legal. This disclosure greatly undermined the public's trust in the Department of Justice and our national intelligence agencies, and it took Congress and the executive branch years to sort the situation out.
Like many senators, including Tea Party Republican Rand Paul, Colorado Democrat Mark Udall decried the lack of debate on the issue.
The process by which we've considered these provisions has been rushed, and I believe we've done a disservice to the American people by not having a fuller and more open debate about these provisions.
The current extension covers three controversial provisions: warrantless wiretapping, the pursuit of so-called lone wolf operatives, and access to business records. The U.S. Supreme Court yesterday upheld an Arizona law that penalizes businesses that hire undocumented immigrants. The law requires employers to determine citizenship by checking employee social security numbers in the federal E-Verify database. Businesses who repeatedly violate the law could lose their business license. 4 states already have similar laws, and 31 others have introduced legislation to do the same. Thousands of people protested today in Egypt's Tahrir Square, pushing the interim military government to move forward on promises of reforms. Some organizers tried to bill the protest as the second revolution, but recent efforts have been hampered by threatened fracturing of protest groups. And finally, gay rights organizers in Russia say they will go forward with a planned Moscow Gay Pride Parade tomorrow, despite being denied a permit. Police in the city say they will enforce the ban on the parade. GLBT rights groups applied for a permit but were denied by the city government, according to RIA News, because police couldn't guarantee their safety against religious, nationalist, and parents groups who have opposed the action. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco. In Washington late yesterday, U.S. lawmakers passed a nearly $700 billion defense authorization bill for the 2012 fiscal year. The White House warned it would veto some provisions in the Republican-sponsored budget, including one that restricts the U.S. president's ability to limit nuclear weapons and another that prevents the transfer of detainees in Guantanamo to the U.S. mainland. The House bill, which still has to go to the Senate, is about $1 billion greater than the defense budget originally requested by the White House. Robert Nayman, Policy Director of Just Foreign Policy, followed the debate, and he joins us now. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Good to be with you.
What do you see as some of the more significant elements that actually made it into this bill?
Well, I think the most spectacular result was the vote of 416-5. The House adopted an amendment brought forward by Representative Conyers that explicitly prohibits the introduction of U.S. ground troops to Libya. And this is in a context where since the war began a little more than 60 days ago, neither the House nor the Senate, has taken any action on the war. And in fact, last week, the 60-day window of the War Powers Resolution expired. So it's sort of openly the case that under U.S. law, the administration is now conducting an illegal war. Another related provision that got in was Representative Garrett introduced an amendment affirming that nothing in this act authorizes U.S. military action in Libya. And that passed without even a vote. I mean, it was just a voice vote. There wasn't a recorded vote. So uncontroversial was this assertion. In a report on this in ABC News, it speculated that this augurs well for what might happen next week. Representative Kucinich is expected to introduce a privilege resolution calling for full U.S. military withdrawal from the conflict in accordance with the War Powers Resolution. And the reporter, Jake Tapper, asked the House leadership aide, GOP leadership aide, well, does this mean that the Kucinich resolution might pass? And the answer was, well, we don't know. So it could be the case that this means that next week the House will vote to withdraw U.S. military forces from Libya. And I think that puts a lot of pressure on the White House to move to de-escalate, because I don't think they want to lose a vote in the House on this with U.S. military troops engaged in combat there.
Another interesting thing that jars, perhaps, is that with a U.S. budget deficit under this bill, defense will get more money than the White House asked for. Was there any discussion at all about how this is going to be paid for?
It is the case that there is a big constituency in Congress for military on spending, unfortunately. You know, there a lot of military spending means contracts in people's districts. And so there's a tendency for Congress to pad the budget. So but this isn't the last round of this debate. It's going to go to the Senate, and then the two will have to be reconciled. In some cases, some of the provisions will be under White House veto threat. So it's not the end of the story, and I think the long-term trend is that nonetheless, despite the padding, U.S. military spending has to come down. There's a wide recognition of this that includes the administration.
In addition to what actually got into this bill, what didn't get into it could be more important. By just 6 votes, the House failed to adopt a bipartisan amendment that called for an accelerated withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. How significant do you see that?
I think it's very significant. I think it's historic. If you compare the 204 votes for the McGovern-Amash Jones amendment in July of last year, there were 162 votes for a similarly motivated amendment. So that's a big increase. And the fact that it was so close, I think, sends a signal to the White House that they've essentially lost the House on the war. You know, six members who voted no probably thought about voting yes. So I think this is probably the last vote the White House can win under the current policy. And that will add pressure for the White House to change its policy, including ordering a substantial drawdown of troops this year and showing people a real end date for when the U.S. Military involvement there is going to end. Only eight Democrats voted no on this amendment, essentially the whole House Democratic caucus. And 26 Republicans also voted for it, which is three times as many as voted for a timetable in July of 2010. So it represents a very big shift in the House.
Robert Naiman, Policy Director at Just Foreign Policy, thanks for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
Good to speak with you.
Senate Republicans have vowed to block Elizabeth Warren's appointment to head the country's new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Warren, a Harvard professor tapped to run the fledgling agency, has come under attack by Republicans on Wall Street who largely oppose more regulations protecting consumers. The Senate has refused to adjourn for Memorial Day recess in order to prevent the Obama administration from confirming her this weekend. For more, Michael Lawson spoke with Bart Naylor of Public Citizen, a consumer rights advocacy group.
Dodd-Frank is almost a year old, including, you know, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. What is the source of this recent sort of Republican rancor over the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and what it's supposed to do?
Well, the most recent rancor, I think, is rooted in the fact that the promise of the law is shortly going to become the reality of the law. If I may, the objection to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau stems from the conception to the debate to the passage and to the stand-up. What we've witnessed, for example, last Tuesday may be one of the most intense expressions of conservative and banker disapproval, but it's not the first that we've seen that rancor being expressed.
This Memorial Day recess, the Senate has not gone into recess because Jeff Sessions, the Republican ranking member, says that it's because of the budget. However, Jim DeMint is on record saying, oh, we're glad that they're not able to make recess appointments because there has been a liberal push for a recess appointment of Elizabeth Warren. Why are they so afraid of Elizabeth Warren?
As Barney Frank and Brad Miller of the House Financial Services Committee apparently unfair, deceptive, and abusive practices have been the central value proposition of our financial industry. And so the Dodd-Frank bill has in it as its hallmark an agency that is officially charged with combating unfair, abusive, deceptive practices. And I'm using those words carefully because that's what's in the law. Now it appears that Elizabeth Warren promises to do what the law charges her to do, that is to confront and end unfair, abusive, and deceptive practices. For your radio listeners, I have in my hands yesterday's mail. It's a very elegant credit card application from American Express. It's an invitation for a five-course dinner from a Christian investment house or a lawsuit protection thing. All of this stuff, if you read the fine print, basically says sign up for this and we're going to sneak in a whole bunch of fees that are going to bilk you. Well, again, there's going to be some person and some agency that may actually put an end to this. And this is how they've made money. This is how they hope to make money. And they certainly don't want anybody stopping them. And that's why they're so upset that Ms. Warren and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau might come into existence.
The GOP senators have said they will not confirm anyone before certain rules are changed within the Bureau. Talk a little bit about these rules for a moment.
I find that pretty impressive for lawmakers to say that they actually don't have to obey the law. Dodd-Frank is the law of the land. And what they basically declared is, because we don't like the law, we're going to not obey it. You have to change the law before certain parts of the law can be implemented, such as the appointment of somebody to head it. It's as if to say, you know, I don't like paying school teachers that much money. So until you pay them less, I'm not going to pay my taxes. It's a breathtaking conceit.
Ms. Warren is not interested in being the head. Are there any other names waiting in the wings, considering that it's approaching July and the Bureau is supposed to be up and running?
I'm not aware of other names. Public Citizen publicly endorses Ms. Warren. I have read that other worthy individuals in the United States have been invited to be considered, and I've also read that they have very nobly said no. There's one good ideal candidate for this job, and it's Elizabeth Warren. Don't even think about me.
By law, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau will begin work on July 21st. A bill passed by the House Financial Services Committee seeks to replace the director of the Bureau with a bipartisan committee. The G8 summit in the French seaside resort town of Deauville has ended. Leaders from the world's top eight economies announced $20 billion in aid and loans to Tunisia and Egypt to foster the democratic governments emerging from the Arab Spring uprisings. President Barack Obama was there and used the occasion to emphasize the G8's united call on Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi to step down.
Meeting the UN mandate of civilian protection cannot be accomplished when Gaddafi remains in Libya, directing his forces in acts of aggression against the Libyan people. And we are joined in resolve to finish the job.
G8 leaders also heard from the heads of leading internet companies at another meeting in Paris earlier this week. The EG8 summit, sponsored by French President Nicolas Sarkozy, brought together executives from Google, Facebook, and other media giants in the hopes of reaching consensus on global regulations governing the internet. Activists there pushed for an internet bill of rights to protect free speech online. Lawrence Lessig from Harvard University's Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics spoke at the EG8 summit, and he joins us now. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Glad to be here.
Western governments love Facebook and Twitter for their role in the Arab Spring uprisings and yet show considerable disquiet about the internet being used to spread information about the inner workings of their own governments, like WikiLeaks has done. Did Western governments fully support this E8 summit, do you think?
I think they fully supported the kind of tame, civilized version of what the internet should be or should become that was presented to them by large incumbent companies that had paid to be at the summit and were invited to be at the summit. But of course, that has little connection to what the internet is or should be, and the idea that public policy should proceed from that kind of meeting, I think, is deeply troubling.
At this meeting, you called for light touch internet regulation from governments. What did you mean exactly, and what legislation is actually needed?
Well, I called for light touch not because deep down I'm opposed to the idea of sensible regulation, but because I think governments have shown us little evidence that the regulation they would enact is much more than just a way to protect the incumbents that are so powerful in influencing at least governments like the government in the United States. So it's not that there aren't problems the internet needs to deal with or need to be addressed in the context of the internet, like privacy or copyright or security issues or problems of monopoly. It's just that our governments have been so bad at demonstrating that they could actually address those questions in ways that advance the values of the internet as opposed to protecting dominant industries in their own countries. So I think that the critical thing for governments to do is to preserve the architecture of innovation that the internet originally gave us because of the way that it was designed. So regulations that preserve its openness and assure broadband penetration and avoid capture of broadband pipes by content providers and assure content and ensure neutrality. Those are the essential regulations that I think the internet needs. And if governments demonstrate they can do better than that by liberating themselves from the control of the dominant incumbents, then maybe we can talk about something more.
Recently, the Electronic Frontier Foundation and the American Civil Liberties Union have been fighting a government bid to collect the private records of three Twitter users as part of its investigation related to WikiLeaks. Does the U.S. government have too much control already over the internet, do you think?
Well, the U.S. government's legal theory for the rights that it has to gather information is really unbounded. It believes that in the context of an investigation, it has the right to demand the production of information from servers and from companies, from anybody worldwide, actually, and it tries to exercise that authority. And this is partly a result of us not actually achieving clear sense of what privacy in the internet age should be. And one of the reasons we've not done that is that the incumbents that influence the United States government so powerfully are not eager to have the United States government actually articulate concepts of privacy that might limit the government's own ability to gather data. So we don't see any progress in the context of that issue at all.
You've just got back from this E8 meeting in Paris, and under new European Commission rules, while you were at that meeting, they approved a ban on European companies from using cookies to track and store personal information without a customer's explicit consent. Is anyone pushing for those sorts of rules in the US, and did you find that possibly the Europeans are more advanced on this sort of thing than we are here in the US?
Well, certainly the approaches are different with respect to privacy in the U.S. And in Europe. I'm personally not convinced that the cookies ban is the most effective way to protect privacy. I think the conflict, though, between the U.S. approach and the European approach points to a more fundamental gap in thinking about, you know, what's the right way to protect these values. I think Sarkozy thought the way to get over that gap in thinking was to get the biggest companies together and just have them tell him what good policy should be. And my own view is that way of trying to resolve these policy questions is wrong, that what business thinks is in its best interest may be in its best interest, but it doesn't follow it's in the public interest, and government should be seeking a public interest here, not the interest of the biggest companies on the internet.
Lawrence Lessig from the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics at Harvard University, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
In New York, opposition to a federal program called Secure Communities is gathering momentum. The immigration reform program requires local police to report arrested immigrants to federal authorities for possible deportation. But many activists and some lawmakers oppose the program, saying it violates human rights and hurts the public's relationship with the police. They're demanding that the New York governor end the program immediately. From New York, Salim Rizvi reports.
The so-called Secure Communities program was started by the Bush administration in 2008. Under the program, local and state police are required to run information of detained or arrested people through an immigration database. If the authorities find that the arrested person is living illegally in the United States, or even if legal but with a criminal record, deportation proceedings can begin. The Obama administration has expanded the Secure Communities program, which Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano said resulted in the detention of more than 50,000 convicted criminal aliens in 2010.
We have been focusing on those in the country illegally who have also been committing other crimes, who are really impacting the public safety of the United States. And so while in the last 2 years we've actually removed more illegal immigrants from the country than any 2 years prior, something that I think the public should recognize. And half of those are people who have committed other crimes as well. And as we continue to deploy a system called Secure Communities, that percentage of removals who are actually those who are also in our criminal justice system will only go up.
But opposition to the controversial program has also grown. In New York, more than 80 rights organizations and faith community leaders have joined to form New York State Working Group Against Deportation. They are asking New York Governor Andrew Cuomo to rescind the Secure Communities Agreement signed by the previous governor with the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. Opponents say the program lacks due process, leads to racial profiling, and deters community members from reporting violent crimes. Manisha Vazey is with Families for Freedom, a New York-based organization for immigrants' rights.
Communities are very, very fearful of accessing the police. They're also fearful because they believe that the police is somehow stopping people if they look like immigrants, and just presents this opportunity for extreme racial profiling that many, many immigrant communities really fear already. So it continues to push people more into the shadows. It continues to keep people unsafe in the sense that they don't want to access the police when they need help.
Rights groups say the Secure Communities program threatens civil rights and weakens public safety as it affects thousands of immigrants, even those booked for minor infractions. They say many immigrants under deportation proceedings are denied bail and are jailed for longer durations. They also have limited access to lawyers, their families, and medical care. Franz Jadine, a Haitian immigrant, is facing deportation under the program after his arrest for fraud in Boston. Now he is also an immigrant rights activist with Families for Freedom.
I spent almost 16 months in detention, and then which is I was fighting for my incarceration because everything in my case was wrong. And I do a hunger strike for almost 1 month. And I get beating by some security guard. And then they transfer me from Boston, Massachusetts to all the way to Miami, Florida, in quorum detention. And I get sexually abused in quorum detention also by some agent of ICE and beating by them. And then it's pretty hard on me, basically, based on all those things happening in my life, I lost everything.
According to a group of human rights lawyers who analyze data from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the majority of the immigrants deported under Secure Communities program have either been picked up for low-level violations or had no criminal records. And a study done by the research and advocacy group Justice Strategies on Immigrant Inmates in New York City's Rikers Island Jail discovered no association between the level of the offense committed and the targeted deportation. Udi Olfer is with the New York Civil Liberties Union, one of the groups opposing Secure Communities.
New York and other states around the country are really at a crossroads right now, where they have to make a decision about whether they're going to go down the failed path of the Bush administration and implement a program that is infamous, that is destructive, and that is unduly expensive and unjust, or are they going to treat all immigrants who live in their states with dignity and respect? And Governor Cuomo needs to make a decision about whether Secure Communities will be implemented in New York or not.
38 state senators signed a letter to New York Governor Andrew Cuomo urging him to end the program, which has already been activated in 27 counties so far. Technically, states can opt out of this program, but any state that declines to share fingerprints through the program will lose access to the federal criminal databases and those of other states. While the state waits for a decision on Secure Communities from Governor Cuomo, opponents have been emboldened by Illinois Governor Pat Quinn, who ended the program in his state with the support of local law enforcement. Salim Rizvi, FSR in New York City.
And that's the program for today and this week. The newscast was produced by Molly Stentz. Headlines editor, Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Michael Lawson. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Scott Pham and Jane Chang. Tune in Monday for a special Memorial Day documentary about Hawaii. And for more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.